Welcome back, listeners. If you're hearing this, you made it through another week. Congratulations. Not everyone can say the same. Tonight's episode isn't about ghosts or demons or things that hide in the shadows. Tonight is about something far more terrifying: the human will to survive, and the unspeakable things we become when that will is tested. So turn off the lights, lock your doors, and whatever you do, don't think too hard about what you would do in their position. Because once you start down that road, there's no coming back. Let's begin. Story 1. I was 23 when I took the job on the Celestine Duchess. Fresh out of hospitality college in Southampton. No girlfriend, no real plan. Just a contract, a uniform, and the vague idea that working on a luxury liner would be more interesting than managing a premier inn off the M3. I mean, technically it was. I just didn't know what kind of interesting I was signing up for. My job title was junior steward. Basically, I brought people towels shaped like swans and remembered that the woman in cabin 847 wanted her chamomile tea at 7 sharp. Simple stuff. The Celestine Duchess ran a circuit, Southampton to the Azores, 3 days at sea each way. And after a few weeks, the routine felt like muscle memory. Wake up, press uniform, smile, serve, sleep. Repeat. The ship had 12 decks. I knew every one of them. That's what made it strange when Marco, a senior steward, Spanish, had worked the route for 4 years, mentioned deck 13 in passing one night. We were in the crew mess, about 11:30, both exhausted. "Did you finish the turndowns on 13? He asked, not looking up from his coffee. I laughed. "There is no 13. He looked at me then, just for a second. Something moved behind his eyes, not quite fear, but close to it. Like a door almost opening. Then he shrugged. "You're right. I'm tired. Forget it." I forgot it. For about 2 weeks. Looking back, I realized the signs were there before that conversation. I just wasn't paying attention. It started with the manifest. Every voyage, passenger services printed a full guest list. Names, cabin numbers, dietary requirements. I used it to personalize service. Little touches. Remember someone's anniversary, upgrade their fruit basket. Standard stuff. But on our third crossing, I noticed a name I didn't recognize alongside a cabin number that didn't match our deck layout. Cabin 13-04. Occupant, Hargreaves, E. No first name, no dietary notes, no embarkation port listed. I assumed it was a data entry error, obviously. I flagged it with passenger services and the woman at the desk. Karen, mid-40s, never without her reading glasses on a chain, just glanced at it and said, "Don't worry about that one." Then she went back to her spreadsheet. I didn't push it. I didn't want to seem difficult this early in my contract. The second thing happened close to midnight on a Wednesday, mid-Atlantic. I was doing a late beverage run on deck 8, when I heard footsteps from above. Steady, unhurried footsteps, walking back and forth. Which shouldn't have bothered me. Ships are full of people, obviously. Except the space directly above deck 8 on the Celestine Duchess is a maintenance crawlway. Not a passenger area. Not a crew area. A crawlway you'd have to be deliberately trying to access to find. I stood there in the corridor with a tray of sparkling water and listened to someone pace, slowly for almost 4 minutes. Maybe I was just paranoid. I told myself it was pipes. The ocean does strange things to sound, Marco always said. I let it go. I should have trusted my instincts. I know that now. The third thing I couldn't explain away. I was restocking the linen cupboard on deck 10 when a passenger stepped out of a door at the far end of the corridor. an older man, very pale, in a dinner jacket that looked like it belonged to a different decade. Wide lapels, slightly yellowed at the collar. He walked slowly, deliberately, like someone who wasn't in any hurry because they had nowhere to be. He turned and looked at me. His eyes opened wider than they should have, not dramatically, just fractionally too wide. The way a face looks when the muscles underneath aren't quite responding correctly. He smiled, and I felt my heart sink straight through the floor, because that smile was assembled, like he'd seen smiling done and was having a go. I looked away. When I looked back, he was gone. I walked to the end of that corridor. The door he'd come from, I checked the number. Cross-referenced it with my layout sheet, which I'd started carrying everywhere by that point. The cabin didn't exist on any blueprint I had access to. I went to the chief purser that night. She was a tall Scottish woman named Diane. Efficient? No nonsense. I explained everything. The manifest entry, the footsteps, the man. She listened with her hands folded on her desk. Then she said, very quietly, "How long have you been with us?" 2 months, I said. She nodded. "The ocean has its own rules out here. International waters, you understand? Different laws, different..." She paused. "Different arrangements." "What does that mean?" "It means," she said, choosing each word carefully, "that some guests book passage through channels we don't manage directly, and some guests," another pause, "don't disembark with the others. I'd strongly suggest you stop looking into cabin 1304, finish your contract, and request a land-based transfer in the spring." She smiled. It reached her eyes perfectly. I almost wished it hadn't. I'll never forget the last morning of that crossing. Southampton in sight, pale November light on the water, passengers crowding the upper deck with their phones out. I counted them as they filed off the gangway. I don't know why, just felt compelled to. I counted one more than the manifest listed. He was near the back of the queue. Dinner jacket, wide eyes. He turned and looked up at me leaning on the rail, and that assembled smile spread across his face like something spilled. Then he walked into the crowd on the dock, and I lost him. I transferred to shore operations in February. I still work for the company, logistics, Southampton terminal, nothing that involves boats. My friends think it's a strange choice. I mean, the pay's worse. To this day, I still count people in queues, in restaurants, getting off trains. I can't help it. I just need to know the numbers add up. They usually do. Usually. Story 2. A black car waited on the street again, its headlights off, its windows dark, like a pair of watching eyes. Tom noticed it first on a rainy Wednesday night, when he couldn't sleep. He had gone to the window for air, pushing the curtain aside just enough to peer out. The quiet street in his small UK town was usually empty after 10, but there it sat, a black car, parked right across from his house, motionless. He didn't think much of it at first. Maybe someone visiting a neighbor, maybe someone waiting for a friend. But the next night, it was back. Same spot, same stillness. And on the third night, when he pulled the curtain open just a little too fast, he felt a jolt run through him. The car hadn't just been there. It felt like it was already looking at him. He told himself he was being silly. Cars parked on streets all the time. But each night it returned. And each night Tom watched it longer. He began waking up at the same hour, 2:13 a.m., as if the sound of its engine turning off echoed through his dreams. He never heard it arrive, never heard it leave. It was simply there, and then gone before sunrise. By the end of the week, The sight of it made his stomach twist. The streetlights left long shadows across the car's roof. The windows were always too dark, even when the rest of the street reflected faint gold from the lamps. He never saw anyone inside. He tried telling his parents, but his mom only frowned and said it was probably someone working late shifts. His dad joked about secret agents. Tom didn't laugh. He started checking earlier in the evening, 9, 10, 11, midnight. No car. But around that same time, every night, when the town fell into its deepest quiet, it showed up again. One night, he decided he wouldn't look. He would stay in bed. He would keep his eyes shut. But as the minutes dragged by, he felt a prickling along his arms, a pressure, like someone was expecting him. His heart beat faster. He got up. He pulled the curtain aside an inch. The car sat exactly where it always did. But this time, something was different. The back door was open. Tom froze. The open door faced his house, angled toward his bedroom window. The inside was pure black, darker than the night around it, like it swallowed the light. He waited for a person to step out, or step in, or close the door. But nothing moved. He stayed at the window until his eyes burned. Finally, he crawled back to bed, but he didn't sleep. The next morning, when he left for school, he glanced at the curb. The car was gone, of course. No marks on the road, no sign anything had been there. He tried to shake off the memory of the open door, but it stayed with him like a cold breath on his neck. That night, he forced himself to stay awake until the usual time. When the clock struck 2:13, he moved slowly to the window, palms sweating, breath shallow. The street was empty. A wave of relief washed over him. Maybe it was over. Maybe whoever it was had moved on. He was about to step away when he noticed something odd, a scrap of white against the pavement. He leaned closer. There, right where the car always parked, lay a folded piece of paper. No breeze moved it, even though the trees shook softly in the wind. Tom hesitated. Then he crept downstairs, careful not to wake his parents, and unlocked the front door. He stepped outside, barefoot, the cold ground biting his skin. The paper sat still on the street, waiting. He bent down and picked it up. It was a photo, his house, his street, taken from the exact place where the car always parked. And in the window, his window, he saw himself standing there, pale, eyes wide, looking straight at the camera. The photo shook in his hands. He had never seen anyone outside, never heard a camera. But the picture was sharp and close, clear as day. He backed away, almost tripping over the curb, and sprinted inside. He locked the door twice and ran upstairs. He shut the curtains tight. For hours he lay awake, heart hammering, waiting for the sound of a car engine outside. Nothing came. But just when he felt the exhaustion pull him toward sleep, he heard it. A quiet tap against the glass. He didn't move. His breath stopped. Another tap. Soft. Slower this time. He pulled the covers up to his chin. The tapping came again, a gentle knock as if someone wanted him to open the curtains. Tom squeezed his eyes shut. The tapping stopped. Morning came with pale light and birds outside. Tom opened the curtains with shaking hands. No car, no person, just the empty street. But on the windowsill, caught under a small stone, lay another photo. This one wasn't of the house. It was of the inside of his room, taken from where he had stood last night. Someone had been in the house. He grabbed the photo with numb fingers. The center of the picture showed his bed. And on it lay a figure curled up under the blankets. Him. But the figure's face wasn't visible. Only the shape of a body turned away. Tom stared at the image until the edges blurred. He wasn't sure when the picture had been taken. He wasn't sure how anyone had gotten inside. But the worst part was this small detail in the bottom corner. A shadow on the floor, long, tall, stretching from the doorway toward the bed. It wasn't his. The story's final line settles like cold air. Tom realized the car hadn't been watching his house at all. It had been watching him. Story 3. The drawer had been locked since the day they moved in, and Tom had promised not to touch it. But the sound inside it made him freeze halfway across the room. He stood in the dim hallway of the old flat, listening. There it was again, a soft tap, like something small shifting against wood. His mom was out for her night shift. The flat felt too quiet, too hollow, the kind of quiet that made every breath sound loud. He stepped closer. The drawer belonged to the bedroom built-in dresser, one that came with the flat. Everything else in the place was new, or at least modern enough. But that dresser looked older, darker, carved with patterns he couldn't name. When they first moved in, the landlord waved at it and said, "Bottom drawer sticks, best not fuss with it." Tom had tried once. It didn't stick. It was locked. And now something inside was moving. He knelt and pressed his ear to the cool wood. The tapping stopped. He whispered a shaky, "Hello?" and immediately felt stupid. Silence. He should have walked away. Instead, he reached for the small screwdriver set he kept in his desk drawer, meant for fixing bike chains. His hand shook as he slid the tip into the lock. The metal scraped, loud in the quiet room. He paused again, listening. Nothing moved this time. The lock clicked open. He pulled the drawer gently. It slid out without a sound. The smell that drifted up was cold and dusty, like old books forgotten in a loft. Inside lay three objects: a small brass bell, a bundle of black string tied in a knot he didn't recognize, and a square Polaroid photograph face down. Tom swallowed hard. The photograph felt the worst somehow, like touching it would cross a line. He picked up the bell instead. It looked handmade, a bit dented, but heavy. When he tipped it, it didn't ring, no clapper inside. His fingers tingled, a faint prickling. He set it down quickly. Next was the string. It wasn't just knotted, woven, spiraled, pulled tight in a pattern that looked almost like a symbol. He nudged it back into place. Finally, the photo. His chest tightened. He lifted it by the corner. The white border was yellowed. When he turned it over, he stopped breathing. It was a picture of the hallway outside his flat. Not just any hallway, their hallway. The same scuffed skirting board. The same faint stain on the wallpaper. And in the corner of the frame, partly cut off, stood a figure. A person. Someone tall, leaning slightly, as if listening at his front door. Tom stared at the picture until his eyes hurt. He checked the timestamp printed on the bottom. The ink had faded but was still clear. It was taken last week. He dropped the photo and stumbled back. His pulse hammered. Who had been here? Why was there a picture in a locked drawer that hadn't been opened in years? He backed into the wall and kept staring at the dresser, as if something might crawl out. The flat felt colder now, the kind of cold that didn't come from weather. A soft sound echoed down the hallway. Tom jerked his head up. Footsteps, slow, careful, coming from the living room. He forced himself to move, quietly. He peeked around the corner. The living room was dark except for the faint glow from the streetlights outside. The window blinds trembled slightly, though the windows were shut. He held his breath. Tap! The same sound from the drawer, but louder now. He followed the sound with his eyes. It wasn't coming from the dresser this time. It came from the front door. Something tapped on the other side. Tom's whole body went cold. He stepped back, bumping into the sofa. His throat tightened as another tap came, a little quicker, like someone impatient. He looked at the photo on the floor in the next room. The figure leaning at the door. Tap. This one came with a soft exhale, like a breath brushing the wood. Tom scrambled into the bedroom, grabbed the drawer's contents, and shoved them back in, except the photo, which he stuffed into his pocket. He pushed the drawer closed and pressed his palm flat against it. It clicked, softly. Locked, again. Tap. This one sounded sharper, almost annoyed. Tom backed away from the dresser, his breathing too loud in his own ears. He grabbed his phone from the bed and dialed his mum. Straight to voicemail. He whispered, "Come on, pick up." But she didn't. The flat felt smaller by the second. The air felt too tight. He stepped toward the window, then stopped. A shadow moved across the frosted glass of the front door. Slow. Sliding across like a hand trailing. Tom's legs almost gave out. He forced himself to stand still. Wait. Listen. Even the tapping stopped. The silence felt alive. He didn't know how long he waited. Maybe minutes, maybe longer. But when he finally peeked into the hallway again, the shadow was gone. The door was still closed. He grabbed his jacket and shoved his feet into trainers, not even tying them properly. He kept his back to the wall as he moved. When he reached the door, he listened again. Nothing. He opened it a crack, peeked outside. The hallway was empty. He slipped out, locked the door behind him, and ran down the stairs until his lungs ached. He didn't stop until he reached the street, where lights and passing cars made the world feel normal again. He told himself he'd never go back alone at night. He'd wait for his mum. He'd pretend the drawer never opened. But as he turned the corner, catching his breath under a street lamp, he finally pulled the photo from his pocket. His stomach tightened. The timestamp had changed. It no longer showed last week. It showed tonight. The figure in the photo wasn't leaning anymore. It stood right at the door, facing the camera. And now, the grainy shape looked a little more like him.